this. New York, London, Paris, Munich, everybody talk about
Reaching Up with Don Fess. Don Fess.
This is Don Fess, and we're reaching up again right now. All together in 204 countries with great in-person guests and music. Happy Hanukkah. Our guest from Washington, D.C. and Queens, New York, was called here to Portland the same time I was. I first met her at her congregation's joyous High Holy Day services. Panay Or Rabbi Deborah Kolodny joins me here on Reaching Up Today Around the World for a not-to-be-missed discussion. Thanks for being with us today, but let me start off by asking you what your background was before you became a rabbi.
Okay. I was raised in New York City by devoutly secular parents who made a god out of no god, which means that I was celebrated Hanukkah with an electronic menorah and Passover with a meal, but not a Seder, and had no other Jewish life in my home whatsoever. At 16, I went on an exchange trip to Israel and had what I consider to be my first experience of God at the Kotel, or the Western Wall, in Jerusalem, which sent me on a path of seeking for the next 20 years until I realized, oh, I was born Jewish into a Jewish family, and I had my first experience of God at a Jewish holy site, so maybe I should explore Judaism more deeply. So that's the spiritual trajectory. I explored metaphysics and shamanism and Quakerism and Taoism, and then came home to Judaism in my mid-30s. As a young child, I was raised by parents who were also very, very politically aware and progressive, and I was a little radical kid, and I went to women's rights marches and other kinds of protests, and I decided I wanted to go to law school to become a civil rights lawyer. I did go to law school, and I graduated in 1985 when Reagan had been in office for about 5 years. All the money for legal services had dried up, and there were literally no jobs to be found for a young progressive lawyer. So I made my way into the labor movement. I had an undergraduate degree in labor relations, and the labor movement seemed like a great container for my politics. And I worked in the labor, in and with the labor movement for about 15 years before I turned my gaze towards being a spiritual professional.
Anything particularly that made you decide to become a rabbi?
Well, when I had this realization in my mid-30s that I was born a Jew and had my first spiritual experience in a Jewish holy site, I went to a congregation that was conducting an adult bat mitzvah class. And so I started a course of study of 18 months. And I learned about the liturgy, and I learned we studied Torah, and we learned how to lane, how to chant the Torah. And my experience within the first month of studying Torah was that I had re-entered a conversation that I felt like I had been in for, I'm not kidding, thousands of years. There was something about the text that felt familiar, that I already knew. I went right from, there's a model of Torah study called the Pardes model, which looks at four levels of analysis. The Peshat, which is the literal meaning of the text, the Remez, which is like metaphor or parable, Midrash, which is, or Drash, which is kind of the stories between the lines, and Sod, which is the mystery. And I felt like I just dove right into the Sod, that I had understandings of the spiritual, the meta-spiritual principles and themes that were contained in our holy text without anyone ever having taught them to me or without my ever having studied them. And so profound was this intellectual experience that I felt called to the rabbinate. I was in my mid-30s, and I really didn't know a word of Hebrew, and I had no container. As I said, I was raised by secular wolves, so I had no really context to put this in. So I spent the next 10 years deciding whether or not I would pursue this calling, and arguing with it, and negotiating with it, and really not being clear about it until my mid-40s, which is when I finally went to seminary.
It's kind of strange the way that works, because if you hear anybody's story, spiritual story, it seemingly doesn't come from within us. Mm. Well, that's subject to interpretation, obviously. But it comes from above, And often we're kind of bewildered by it at mm-hmm. first, like you're talking about. Mm-hmm. But if we submit to it, all kinds of wondrous things happen.
There's no doubt. I mean, submission is an interesting word since it is so core to the Islamic faith. Not as core principle, really, in the Jewish tradition, at least in the exoteric tradition, you know, that most people are aware of. My experience was that as I was negotiating, mostly pushing away this calling, I found myself in extreme distress and unhappiness. And it took a dear, dear friend to draw my attention to the fact that I was resisting my destiny. And perhaps that is what was causing my unhappiness, for me to sit back and say, oh, I think you have a point. And my negotiations were very sophisticated. I'm very smart. I was running a nonprofit Jewish organization, the headquarters organization for the Jewish Renewal Movement. And my negotiations went like this. Well, perhaps I am being deployed in the way I'm supposed to be deployed. I am running, you know, this institution that has a vision of changing the world and bringing deep, mystical, engaged, meaningful Jewish practice back into the world. Isn't that holy work? Isn't that amazing work? And the answer was, yes, it is. But it's not your work, at least not your only work. And I was leading congregations, and I was getting paid to do that, you know. So I was finding ways to deploy myself, all kinds of ways. But, you know, you can only put off, I guess, the inevitable for so long. And it takes longer if you're finding little ways to satisfy the itch, you know, to sate the calling. So,
you're fairly new to Portland, as am I. What do you think of Portland so far?
Yes, I've been here all of 2 months.
Me too.
So what I think of Portland is that it's remarkable, and I actually can't imagine another place that would be a better fit for me. I was very concerned when I moved out here about the grayness, you know, the cloudiness through much of the year, because I grew up on the beach and I'm kind of a sun worshiper. So far so good. There hasn't been that much cloudiness. It's only the end of October.
But I've been warned there will be.
Oh yeah, it's coming. It's definitely coming. So, other than that concern that lingers, but I'm deciding not to worry about it too much, the social justice activism and the environmental consciousness and the incredible beauty of the surrounding area, and the really funky and interesting and affordable housing stock. I mean, you know, there's just every which way I turn, there are things that I find appealing. The amazing, you know, organic, sustainable, gourmet restaurants, you know, it's almost like college town, like, you know, the beautiful college towns. I went to a college in Ithaca. I went to Cornell. It's like that magnified into a whole city. And, yeah, so I love it. So far, I love it. And I have to say the natural environment, other than Israel, this natural environment has called to me much more profoundly than any other place in the world. The Columbia River Gorge, the waterfalls on the way to Multnomah Falls. When I came out here to interview in February, I had an experience of actually the waterfalls telling me that I had come home. So I said to myself, well, these people, you know, they really better make me the offer to be their rabbi, because I don't know how I'm going to make a living if I move home. They don't make me this offer.
I've been talking on the air for the last 2 months about how I was called to come to Portland probably 3 weeks before I actually moved here. Mm. I had no idea that I was moving. Mm. I probably would have told anybody that they were crazy if they told me I was leaving the Bay Area, which is where I've lived for 20 years after New York. As soon as I got here, I felt so incredibly at home, and I felt some of the same things that you're talking about. But Portland has a reputation, as does the whole state of Oregon, for being a very unspiritual place. Now, I don't know where that comes from, because I found just the opposite.
Mm. I've certainly heard that, and there are studies out there, very recent surveys in terms of the Jewish population, that something like 80% or 90% of Portland Jews are not affiliated. And I've heard people contest those surveys. I think what the reputation is trying to speak to is the degree to which there's an independence of spirit here. And there's the independence of spirit translates into independent spirituality as well. So I think a lot of people are engaged in their own personal practice. You know, a lot of people have meditation practices and chanting practices and prayer practices, but they're not necessarily going to church or to the satsang or to synagogue. My point of view is skewed because I'm the rabbi of a congregation, and so who am I meeting? I'm meeting my congregants. I'm meeting the people who are potential congregants. I'm meeting other clergy. I'm hanging out in a lot of interfaith coalitions already. I did some public events around the 9/11 memorial to, you know, for peace work, and I'm part of the welcoming congregations community for congregations across all spectrums. Ecumenical, it's an ecumenical organization that welcome lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. So these, you know, that's the people I'm hanging around with. So after only being here for 2 months, I can't profess to know what the terrain is about. But I have found nothing but deep and abiding and engaged spirituality.
It's interesting that I think it was a Pew study or some other study, if it's not Pew, that recently said that they expect, they were trying to make a point, that in America someday soon there would be 360 million or whatever number of million different religions, meaning that people are getting perhaps more spiritual, more reaching up to God, but not doing it according to anybody else's doctrine.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that a futurist or even a think tank would make such a prediction. And I'm not surprised because I'm a leader in and I kind of reside in this world of Jewish renewal, which it has as its mission the acknowledgement and the desire to make normative the fact that our personal relationship with God is at the center of religious life. And that hasn't been true in many streams of Judaism. For someone like myself, where the lifting up of meditation practices and chanting practices and even text study as a path towards communion or dvekut with God, it's not surprising to me at all that people are attracted to that personal relationship with God and their personal kind of permutation of how to do that. Jewish renewal is all about creativity and meaning and engaging with the traditions of the past, but in a way that have modern relevance and are inclusive and welcoming of a broad spectrum of peoples who have had many different kinds of experiences. Many of us have dual practices. You know, I'm a Tai Chi practitioner. I've been practicing for 15 years. So the Tao is a very important piece of scripture to me. So I'm not surprised by that and not concerned by that.
But there are people who are kind of horrified by it. Let me give you an example. I met with a Portland pastor about 2 weeks ago, and we were discussing the kind of nonprofit work that I do in addition to radio. And I showed him a 12-step book that we created for teenagers, which I'll show you later. And he flipped through it, and he happened to see a symbol that an artist drew on a particular page for the yin-yang. And he just shook his head. No. Like, how could you do this and also be about Judeo-Christian things? And I looked at him and I said, how many Christians do you know who go to martial arts classes, take their kids there, and why do you think that one discipline takes away from another? And he couldn't answer me. He just didn't like it.
You know, fear is a powerful motivator, and fear is generally fueled by, I was going to say ignorance, but lack of knowledge and information. For those of us who have studied deeply the scriptures and practices and rituals of other traditions, at least I can speak for myself, there's no room for fear because all I see is a glorious confluence of ideas and ideals that are framed in different cultural and historical patterns that are relevant to the places in the world where those traditions grew up. But so many truths are represented across many traditions. I see no contradiction whatsoever, for example, between Taoism and Torah. It's a book that's germinating, that's been germinating in me for 10 years now. So for those who have the time or who have had the blessing to be able to engage with people across traditions, engage with what Rabbi Zalman Shachter Shalomi, who's the founder of Jewish Renewal, calls deep ecumenism, we see the beauty and the power of those universal truths. And that's where we meet. And we don't try and whitewash everything so that it's all the same and bland. We rejoice in the differences, and we don't fear them. And we work with and rejoice in the intersections and interconnectivity. I think it's a symbol of something very beautiful. And as I'm talking, I'm remembering there's this phrase of one world religion or something that freaks a lot of people out. And that's certainly not where I'm going at all, because as I say, I love and appreciate the diversity. But people get afraid of all kinds of things. I don't know. God speaks through all of us and to all of us. And we're each here to lift up our very particular, unique piece of that God prism. And, that's just all good as far as I'm concerned.
Reaching Up with Don Fess. Don Fess.
Used to be a blessing for life.
There's a lot of hurting in this society, in this world. Maybe even some in you. But the surest way to change things is to be a blessing. Who can you help? Be a friend to. Show some love to. Be the change you want to see. Be a blessing to someone today and every day. This message from Street Cats, One Heart for Kids, and Celebrate Radio.
We will choose to be a blessing for life.
Back with Rabbi Deborah Kolodny here in Portland.
Since this is radio, not television, and the audience can't see, I'm reaching over for a book that I really haven't read cover to cover yet, but there are some interesting things in it that we might discuss. The book is Muslim, Christian, and Jew, Finding a Path to Peace Our Faiths Can Share. It's by a Dr. David Liepert, who I believe is in Calgary, Canada. He says, in part, religions are supposed to tell us what we need to know, not what we want to hear. We need to know how, and I find this a very awkward sentence that I can't quite wrap my brain around, we need to know how to become what we are supposed to become, and how to do what we're supposed to do. We'd rather hear how to make people do what we want them to do instead. Mm-hmm. And if I can find it, somewhere here, he talks a lot about all three major religions. But he says, the sad truth that all the children of Abraham might do well to face is that none of our religions are functioning the way they're supposed to. Instead of helping us individually become better people today than we were the day before, we've turned them into advertising tools more suited to the manipulation of mobs. So the first time I've heard anything like that, but something to consider. Mm-hmm. I think every believer, he says, no matter his or her background, could agree that our founders would have done just fine living in a multicultural world, if only because instead of arguing over who was better, they would have worked for the benefit of all and let their actions speak for themselves. Every one of them was focused on the product they delivered, a path to peace, self-improvement, and service to God and God's creation, rather than market share. It's only our own anxious self-interest and willful misrepresentation of their intent that has unmade so much of the good work our prophets tried to do. That reminds me that I suddenly know a lot of Christians who worship Jesus and say, and this is in America, that they won't ever call themselves Christians again because of all the other stuff associated with the word that's got little to do with God. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you think that there's some sort of equivalent among Jewish people.
First, I think you tread on treacherous ground anytime you try and make an equivalence between Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, because there are some real fundamental differences. Most frequently, the attempt is to say there's a Judeo-Christian something. And Judaism and Christianity are incredibly different in one very important way, that Judaism is not a proselytizing religion, it's not a missionizing religion. And so we don't market ourselves the way Christians do in an attempt to either control or define or alter other people's behavior. Judaism is all about our own behavior. And in fact, you know, we make it difficult to join the club. So I think the project is a very, very, very different project. And I know less about the Muslim approach to engaging people outside the tradition with a desire to, you know, bring them in. So the first caution I would throw out is a caution against equating the three Abrahamic traditions on any foundation except that Abraham was all of our father, and that we share scriptures, because Muslims too do have a relationship with the Hebrew texts. Second point is, there is no question that people in power of whatever system they are in control over function in ways to preserve the power structure and the hierarchy and the control mechanisms that exist in that system. And that's true of every religion, and it's true of every government, and it's true of every organization and every system, because that's just true of human nature. So there I would say, sure, guilty as charged. And again, sorry to be a commercial for Jewish renewal. I feel like one of the beautiful components of Jewish renewal that really resonates with me is that we take very seriously this notion that we're a mamlechet kohanim, that we are a nation of priests, and that the hierarchy that anyone might imagine, and Judaism doesn't have much hierarchy. I mean, you know, yeah, there are rabbis, but there's not a chief rabbi, you know, like a pope, you know, who oversees everything. And there's many, many different streams of Judaism, and it's a core part of the tradition to argue with your teacher, to argue with your rabbi, because that's the nature, that's how Jewish learning takes place. You go into a Beit Midrash, you know, that is the nature of Jewish thinking. All right, that being said, still we're humans, people in control, want control. In Jewish renewal, we're like, everybody has the capacity to be a teacher. Everybody has the capacity to be a spiritual leader. We want to lift that up. We want to bring people into a relationship with that. So what I think is happening in Jewish renewal is a microcosm, or an example of it, is that while what this gentleman says is true, what's also true is that there are streams within every tradition that are lifting up the individual relationship with God and the individual empowerment, both spiritually and communally. But there's certainly more than one trend going on.
For those people who, some of my audience probably doesn't even know that traditional Judaism, at least Western Judaism, has been divided up into Orthodox and conservative and Reform. Tell us where Jewish renewal fits in all that.
Thank you. So in addition to those streams, which are the biggest streams, there's also Reconstructionism, which is a stream of Judaism that really started being developed in the middle of this last century. Jewish renewal sits outside of that paradigm. So you could say there's four denominations. Jewish renewal doesn't identify as a denomination. We identify as a trans-denominational movement that has as our agenda this vision of energizing and animating and inspiring Jews into a more meaningful and nourishing relationship with Judaism and with God and with Jewish community, Jewish practice, with Jewish prayer, with Jewish study. So while we have 45 affiliated congregations around the world, and we've ordained over 150 rabbis, cantors, and rabbinic pastors, mostly rabbis, which seems to make us look like a denomination. We also have lots of individual members who might identify as conservative, reform, reconstructionist, orthodox, or unaffiliated Jew. And we have events that are open to all. And we work very hard, actually, to reach out to any Jew and anybody who's interested in Judaism to excite and inspire them into a deeper relationship with God. So I would say that we're outside of that denominational paradigm. And we're on a whole different trajectory.
We've talked a little bit about the various faiths, and we've mentioned in this conversation so far interfaith a few times. Do you think that the major faiths, even though they're different and they have their own way of worshiping God and looking at the divine, that they can learn from each other?
We're each here with a purpose. No, there are central core tenets of every tradition that are kind of wisdom keepers, wisdom holders of those tenets. You might have heard me say this during the high holidays, if you were there for the entire period. You know, I identify myself as a tribal person who's in the diaspora, who's in Galut, who's no longer living on my tribal land. Tribal peoples over the eras, over the epochs, have all had a specific relationship with a given plant or a range of mountains or a river or a plain or a species of buffalo that was theirs to protect and hold. And that was the wisdom that they held in relationship to that place and that part of creation. So Jews have the Torah and we have Israel. Lest anybody can be concerned, we can share both of those things. We can live on that land with Palestinian peoples, and we can teach and grow and learn from Torah with other peoples. Those are what we've been given. The Christian people have the Christian scriptures. Muslim people have the Quran and all of the, you know, complementary and commentary writings on it. So there's so much we can learn from each other. And as I said earlier, one of the joys of learning is that the more you learn, the more you realize we're saying a lot of the same things in different ways. People hear things differently. We know that some people are kinesthetic learners. They learn from their body. And some people are visual. And some people are oral. And some people, you know, don't learn unless they do something 100 times or they teach something themselves. So having all the different varieties of expressing the same idea ensures that more people learn it. So whether it's the same idea being expressed in different ways or whole new consciousnesses, we can certainly learn from each other. And thank God, nobody has 100% kind of monopoly on the truth. Life would be so boring. So boring.
In that book that I was quoting, that's a major point that he makes, that nobody has 100% of the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And then one can also bring up, and we could discuss this for hours, which we don't have, if there's only one way, one very precise, narrow way, mm-hmm. why did God create all these different people?
Right.
And different beliefs.
Right. It wouldn't make any sense. It wouldn't make any sense. One of the things I'm really clear about is that we're here to achieve our highest potential. And the only way to achieve one's highest potential is to come up against challenge and paradox, prohibition and limit and pain and joy. I mean, you need the full gamut of human experience to grow. And again, otherwise, what's the point? You know, we'd be born and we'd be bored for whatever, 70, 80, 90 years. That seems a very, you know, the opposite of intelligent design. That seems like silly design. So, you know, in addition to having the diversity of faith practices and teachings, it never made sense to me when people asked, well, if there's a benevolent God, why do bad things happen to good people? Bad things happen because we live in the world of materiality where we are not in control of everything. Thank God. That way we can learn and grow and experience delight. How would we know delight if we didn't know suffering, you know, if we didn't have something to contrast it to?
Rabbi Deborah will join us again in a few weeks.
It's a word that can make us whole. Shalom. Shalom. There is a word that can move tall mountains and raise a valley up to the sky.
This is Don Fass. Join us next weekend and keep reaching up. And be sure to tell us where you're listening. Write me at reachinguprradio@gmail.com. reachinguprradio@gmail.com.
This is the Celebrate Radio Network.
Radio Network.
From Seattle to Paris, Bangkok to Jerusalem.